listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2012 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. Eli Broad, an avid collector of contemporary art, writes how he admires artists because they follow their vision, quote, no matter how strange it seems, according to the conventional wisdom. And he adds, I can relate to that. He's been married for 57 years to the love of his life, whom he says, realized early how unreasonable I was, but who loves and understands him. The advice in his new book ranges from his experience as the builder of two Fortune 500 companies, as a major funder of scientific research institutes and K-12 education reform, as a philanthropist and founder behind some of the world's greatest contemporary art museums, to his experience as a proud and adoring husband. Who you spend your life with, much more so than how you choose to spend it, is the most important decision you can make, he writes. Do it right. Eli Broad is the son of Lithuanian Jewish immigrants who installed in him the values of both hard work and generosity, that you don't have to be rich to give, and that what you give can change the world. Those are values, you will see tonight, that have shaped Eli Broad's philosophy to this day. In a book rich in engaging and anecdotes and human details, Eli Broad now offers lessons in unconventional thinking. I think we can all learn from that. He's joined in conversation tonight by veteran Los Angeles Times writer and editor Jim Newton, who's the award-winning author of two excellent biographical books, Justice for All, Earl Warren and the Nation He Made, and most recently the book he spoke about at Aloud just a few months ago with A. Scott Berg, Eisenhower, The White House Years, which told us many, many things we didn't know about President Eisenhower. I'm so honored. Please join me in welcoming to the stage of the Los Angeles Public Library, Jim Newton and Eli Broad. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you.
Well, thank you all for being here. And especially, thank you, of course, Mr. Broad, who I'm going to call Eli. I hope that's okay with you.
It sure is.
Before we begin, let me just add a little something to what these introductions already have told you. I've been covering LA civic life for a little over 20 years now, and have known Eli for almost all of that time. And one of the things that I have come to realize is that there is no person in this city who has had more influence on more diverse aspects of life in this city over that period than the man who's with you tonight. Whether it is Disney Hall or charter schools or the Grand Avenue or Dick Reardon's mayoralty, you'll find Eli's fingerprints on it. And so that, I should note, also makes Eli controversial in some quarters, and understandably so. There are those who don't like the idea that wealth or taste or even generosity bestows influence. But I think it's safe to say that Eli is not terribly bothered about that. There is a whole chapter in this book titled, It's Better to Be Respected Than Loved, and it is, after all, entitled, Overall, The Art of Being Unreasonable. So with that, I'd like to turn to some questions. With your permission, of course, I'd love to talk about business, art, philanthropy, and I will not let you go without talking about the Los Angeles Times. We'll come to that in a minute. Eli's book debuted a week or so ago. It's on the bestseller list of the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, to which I say congratulations, you bastard. And it also seems to sort of beg the question, which is my way I'd like to start, I guess, which is to ask, why a book? I mean, most people would look at you and say you've had a pretty full life and career. What takes you to book writing?
Jim, over the years, when I started two Fortune 500 companies, people said, how did you do this? How'd you do that? And then when I left the world of commerce about 12 years ago and we started our various foundations in education reform, scientific and medical research, the arts, in downtown Los Angeles, people said, how are you doing all that? So I said, you know what? Maybe I could write a book that would help other people understand how I get stuff done, and perhaps they could learn from it and also learn from my mistakes. Mm-hmm. So I said, okay, we'll write a book. Now, along the way, there was a bright young woman who you introduced us to, Swati Pandey, who was going to write my biography. And frankly, I said, that's nice, and she's still doing that, but why don't we write this book? And she helped me get my words and thoughts in the good prose. Mm-hmm. So I thank her for it.
Well deserved. I read the book, and obviously, and was unsurprised by parts of it and very surprised by other parts of it. And I guess one of the things I wondered about, there's the final chapter in particular, is very personal. I have not, over all the years, thought of you as a terribly introspective person. I mean, you seem like you're always moving forward. And I wonder whether it was hard to write those words about your children, your wife. Did any of that feel uncomfortable either to write or to read back on now?
It wasn't uncomfortable. It was somewhat emotional to write about those things. I thought about all the things I did during my life, how it affected my children, how it affected Edie, and I thought it was appropriate to write.
Uh-huh. And are you glad? So you're glad to end the book on that note?
Yes.
Good for you. It is also a bit of a genre-confusing book in the sense that it's not the How to Be a Billionaire book, and it's not quite a memoir. Does it strike the balance that you were looking for?
It is a balance. It isn't a biography. It isn't a memoir. And it isn't totally a how-to book, but mm-hmm. it's a combination of all three.
Uh-huh. I'm going to get ahead to your business life in just a minute here, but one more just personal question I wanted to ask you. You mentioned in the book that you have dyslexia, and you also mentioned that you read 4 newspapers a day, for which I commend you.
I do.
How do you do that? It seems like that would be a hard goal to set for yourself if you have to deal with your dyslexia.
Well, I grew out of dyslexia. When I had dyslexia, I didn't know what it was, but somehow I grew out of it.
Uh-huh.
And I love getting reading 4 papers a day.
And what does reading 4 papers a day do for you?
I love to be informed. I love to get ideas. I love to learn.
Mm-hmm.
What it does.
As a business person, how does it help you?
As a citizen, a business person, or a philanthropist, mm-hmm. in all those areas.
Okay,
I love reading your column also.
Boy, that's great. You just keep doing that. We'll get along fine. So let's talk about your business life some, and then I would love to talk about philanthropy and the other parts of the book too. Do you regard yourself as having some special ability in business? I mean, is there something that is part of your character or your upbringing or your approach that separates you apart from other people in business?
I think I am different than a lot of other people in business. I don't accept the status quo in anything. Whether it was in business and home building, or when we acquired a life insurance company and changed it to a retirement savings company, or what we're doing in philanthropy. And someone said, you know what, you're never satisfied. Someone else said, you know what, you're a poor winner. Because whenever I get something done, I don't rest on my laurels. I say, what else can we do? Mm-hmm. So I guess I am different.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, if we think about the sort of business history of this country, or Andrew Carnegie, or Steve Jobs more recently, or Warren Buffett, do you imagine those very successful business people who really built empires of both philanthropy and business? Is there something that stitches those people together that you feel a part of that history? Or is there something, rather than make you answer for all of them, what about you and Jobs, say? Do you see things in common between the two of you?
I'll tell you, Walter Isaacson made a comment. He says, you don't know what unreasonable is after writing about Steve Jobs. No, I respect Steve Jobs and all he's done, and his death was a great loss. I think he was the Da Vinci of our time.
And does that quality of unreasonableness in him, do you suspect that it benefited him in business the way it did you?
I mean, it sure did.
How so? I'm curious.
He brought unreasonableness to a higher degree than I did. and he was not always artful in using and being unreasonable.
As opposed to, say, you.
I try to be artful.
Very good.
Not artless.
You write in the book, and for those who read the book, because they really are interested in sort of the business advice of the book, One of the things I was surprised to come upon is you stress really the importance of selecting an advisor rather than selecting stocks or investments for yourself. Why is that? I mean, for people, I guess, who haven't read the book in particular, why is that the emphasis that you placed on that?
Well, I think if you're investing money, you have to be professional and spend your time at it. I was involved in two companies, but when I left the world of commerce, I stopped being an investor. I got very bright people, a chief investment officer, and someone else to really run our family and foundation portfolios, mm-hmm. rather than tinkering around with it myself.
Mm-hmm. And is that a prescription for people who are not at your station, but who are trying to make a fortune? Is that the way you would advise them into it?
I'd advise them to get great advisors to help them, rather than them picking individual stocks and doing this, that, and the other thing.
Mm-hmm. You've already mentioned, and I had here to ask you, you've had a series of careers, of course. As a home builder, as you know, you built more than 100,000 homes, founder of Sun America. Here's a statistic that will stick with all of you, I suspect. The $10,000 invested in Kaufman & Broad in 1961 would have paid off $34.1 million when Sun America merged with AIG. Nice work. And at the same time, you're a philanthropist, you've educated school superintendents, mm-hmm. you've funded medical research, you're an art collector. I wonder which of those careers has given you the greatest satisfaction?
I think the greatest satisfaction I've gotten is since I left the world of commerce, although I was very proud of our record and having a better record actually than Warren Buffett. And having the best performing stock for a decade in the 90s. Mm-hmm. But I feel better about what I'm doing now. I'm working harder than ever before. Got some real challenges out there in education reform. I'm proud of all the things we're doing, scientific and medical research, both in genomics, partners with Harvard and MIT, and stem cell research at three California universities, and things we're doing in downtown Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. And I feel great about that.
And I'm going to talk about... Yes, you're free to applaud. Indeed. How do you pick the areas to target your philanthropy?
Okay, let's start. When I was still in the world of commerce, the first major thing we did was we gave back to my university, Michigan State University, to start a full-time MBA program, and they named a business school after me. And then I was chair of the board of one of the Carolina colleges, Pitcher College. So I gave money for several buildings they needed. But the first thing we did actively was we created an art foundation 27 years ago. And the reason we did that after I stepped down as chair of the board of the Museum of Contemporary Art, I saw that museums didn't have money to buy contemporary art. And our walls at home were filled and said we want to continue collecting. So we created the Art Foundation, which became a lending library of contemporary art to museums and university galleries throughout the world. We made 8,000 loans to 480 different institutions. Then when I left the world of commerce, and we were very fortunate because, as you know, we sold our company to AIG for an awful lot of money, and we were first-size shareholders, I said, now what do we do? And having traveled the world, Korea, Japan, India, China, Finland, elsewhere, I said, they're doing a far better job educating their children than we are. And I thought about that. And I read A Nation at Risk, which was now 23 years of the old. And I said, what can we do in education reform? We didn't have any background curriculum or how to teach anything. So I said, let's approach it from a governance and management point of view. And that's how we got started. And I'm very proud of what we've accomplished. The number of superintendents we've trained, including John Dacey, who's our superintendent here at LA Unified School District, mm-hmm. and about 40 others. And I said, I don't see any young people, MBAs with 5 years experience involved in urban school management or administration. So we create a program there and have several hundred of those people out there. Then we created the Broad Prize because I said, you know, everyone's down in urban education. So why don't we create a big prize, $1 million prize for urban school districts that are doing a great job in improving student achievement while closing the gap between income and ethnic groups. So that's now in its 11th year. So those are some of the things we chose to do. Most of the things we've done, probably 95%, are not things that people come to us with. It's things we come up with that we think need to be done that no one else is doing. Mm-hmm. And it's got to pass three tests. One, if it's going to happen without us, we don't do it. Two, will it make a difference 20 or 30 years from now? And lastly, is there leadership and management there that can make it happen?
And I assume you are approached all the time by causes and people who want you to support them.
Yes, we see philanthropy as different than charity. Charity to me is just writing checks. And we do some of that too, whether it's United Way, this or that. But the major things we're doing are creating institutions that didn't exist, like the Broad Institute and genomics and a number of other things.
Mm-hmm. And just to return to education for a moment, you write in the book, I've seen hundreds of millions of dollars and countless hours of effort spent defending and preserving what is a deeply broken system. Is education especially difficult to reform?
It's very difficult to reform. In science and medicine, I've yet to meet a scientist that wants to maintain the status quo. In education, you run in that daily basis. People don't want to change for one reason or another. And you get a lot of pushback.
Mm-hmm. Where's that pushback come from mostly?
Well, it comes from what I call the adult interests that are threatened by change. Mm-hmm. Whether it's teachers' unions, whether it's administrators and the like. Mm-hmm. It doesn't come from teachers themselves. It comes from their organizations.
And do you feel, I know you're very conscientious about trying to measure progress through your philanthropy. Do you feel like you're making headway in that area?
I think we've made some progress. Is it enough progress? No, it's not. Mm-hmm. And I hope we continue to make progress. Because I'm really concerned with our economy, our standard of living. And 3 weeks ago, the Council of Foreign Relations came out with a lengthy report saying that education was a national security priority because 75% of people 18 to 24 are not fit to serve in the military today. And that's scary.
That's a scary statistic. And yet, I assume it's gratifying to have it elevated to the level of a national security priority.
It is. It is. And I think we've got to change the debate and talk about that.
Mm-hmm. Let me shift gears to L.A. a little bit. You and I first met each other, I think, around the fundraising for Disney Hall, which you'd taken over. And I'd love for you to describe how you came to be part of that project and its significance for the city. Before doing that, though, I wonder if you'd take a moment to, I mean, you and Frank Gehry knew each other before you were united on that project, and it hadn't gone so well, frankly, right? So, will you take a minute and describe your relationship with Frank Gehry pre-Disney Hall?
Frank Gehry and I are now great friends. The Broads and the Gehrys have dinner once every other month or so. Now, Frank designed our house. He did not want to design houses anymore. But I'm unreasonable and persistent. So I convinced him to design our house. 2 years went by, and every design he had, there were seven different designs, I approved. But he wanted to keep going forever. And I ran out of patience. And someone said, you know what, a work of art is never finished, it's only abandoned. So he wasn't happy with my pushing him to finish the design. But we're delighted with the house. Then the next thing that happened was Walt Disney Concert Hall. Lillian Disney gave $50 million. 7 years went by. He had a great design. Nothing was happening. I was looking at this deck above a parking garage. And my friend Dick Reardon and I said, we got to make this happen. So we went out there and raised the money to make it happen. And at the end of that, Frank Gehry had a wonderful event for all of us on stage, thanking us for effort. And I said, you know what? Frank Gehry was right. People say, what did it cost? My answer is, it's priceless.
And what, I mean, it had been such a symbol of this area's inability to get anything done. Talk about it a little bit, if you would, not just so much in terms of the building, but what it said about sort of the evolution of the civic order here in L.A.
It was sad. You know, Los Angeles does not have the traditional philanthropy of other older cities, whether it's New York, Chicago, even San Francisco. So this project was dead, ready to be buried. People said it'll never be built, it can't be built. I didn't believe that. So Dick Greer and I stepped forward. We each gave multi-million dollar pledges to the building and went around and got people to sign up, so to speak. And we told them, it's not about whether you like the architecture or you love the symphony, it's about our city. Mm-hmm. And we made it happen. I feel great about that.
Mm-hmm. Congratulations. Yes, indeed. What would you say to a resident of this city who loves the city, likes living here, and doesn't love modern architecture? And here you're a person who are very active in really shaping the skyline of the city. You're not elected. You're not. What gives you the purview, I guess, to decide what this city looks like?
Well, let's go back to Walt Disney Concert Hall. You may recall that the Los Angeles Times had a lot of people writing in telling about how terrible the Walt Disney Concert Hall design was. And I forget all the words they used, but right. They were hardly kind. Now it's beloved by everybody. And it's a shock of the new. It takes people the time to get used to new things, design of any sort, including architecture.
So I believe
in great architecture. And I'm very proud of the fact that within three blocks on Grand Avenue, you have a new high school for the visual performing arts by Wolf Pree that I was involved in, mm-hmm. a great Viennese architect. You've got, obviously, Walt Disney Concert Hall. You've got a new park coming from City Hall all the way up to the Music Center. Arati Isasaki did MoCA. Rafael Mineo did our cathedral. And we're very excited about our architecture and the Broad Collection. So I can't think of any other city within three blocks where you have such great architecture.
I think you could do something about getting rid of the County Hall of Administration and those who occupy it.
It has to happen if the supervisors would ever agree on a site. There are five different views on where the next Hall of Administration ought to be.
You obviously are known for being unreasonable, and hence the title of your book. And yet, if you think of some of the projects you've just described, Grand Avenue, the Disney Hall, the Broad Institute with MIT and Harvard. You've really been involved in bringing people together, MIT and Harvard, good example, institutions that don't work together very often.
They've never worked together before.
So how is it that unreasonableness works in creating collaboration?
Well, in the case of the Broad Institute, that was quite a story. I met a man by the name of Eric Lander, who was decoding the human genome for the government in October of 01. And I went to see his lab in Cambridge. And I said, when are you going to be done? He said, April of 03. Then what are you going to do? He said, I want to try an institute, create an institute, take all we've learned to clinical application. And I won't go through the whole story, but I said, well, what do you need to do that? And he said, about $800 million, and I wished him well. he couldn't get the money, and people that could have given it to him didn't. So then I played entrepreneur. I said, you know what, Eric? I will give $100 million over 10 years from our foundation if I can get Harvard and MIT to do likewise. And that was quite a negotiation. And I'm proud of the fact that for the first time ever, Harvard and MIT joined forces to do a project. Now has all the brilliant people from Harvard Medical School, the affiliated hospitals, and all the people at MIT working together, and it created a new way to conduct science.
And when you succeed in a project like that, does it make it easier to do the next project to persuade people that they ought to listen to you?
I think I have a pretty good track record. People really look at it, but many things I think about, people say, you can't do that, it's never been done, it doesn't make sense, it's too risky, etc. But I ask, why not? And if I don't get good answers, I move forward.
Right. That, and is that the best you can do? That seems to be a refrain of your book, huh?
Sometimes I ask people that.
Right. If you ask a question and he asks you that later, I can give you advice afterward. let me read a quote, another quote to you from your own book about philanthropy. It says, philanthropy aims to make the world a more peaceful, prosperous, wiser, healthier, and more livable place. Philanthropy may be conceived as an exercise of the heart, but those are goals worthy of our head's best efforts. It's lovely writing, by the way. But how do you apply your head to the work of your heart? How do you mesh those two things in your work?
Not sure I can answer that. Anything I do, I'm passionate about. And I said, if it's something that I believe should be done to create something new or change something for the better, I'm passionate about it. And I use whatever skill I have, and I've had the privilege of getting a lot of bright young people to work with on everything I've done. I don't do all this myself. Mm-hmm. I've been blessed with the ability to get a lot of bright young people that want to work with me. Mm-hmm.
And how do you measure your success at it? How do you know if you're investing in the right things?
We use metrics. For example, in education, it's simple. It's all about student achievement. In the arts, it's about educating a far broader audience about contemporary and other art, or advancing scholarship. In scientific and medical research, it's about advances that will improve the human condition. And you can measure that by the number of articles that appear in scientific and medical journals, etc.
Mm-hmm. And do you ever go back and reconsider? Have you looked at any of your philanthropic exercises and decided that was really just money not well spent?
Sure. We've had some things we wish we hadn't done.
And do you ever think of doing expanding to more, for instance, saving newspapers?
What?
Saving newspapers. Just. I'll be getting back to that in a minute, by the way.
Yeah, that's a challenge. That's too great.
No.
Look. I've long believed that Los Angeles needs a great newspaper, locally owned. And people say, what are you going to do about it? And I say, it ought to be owned by foundations in this city or wealthy families. And if other people move forward and ask me to join them, I would.
Well, you're skipping to dessert for me here.
Okay.
On this. But I will happily quote from your book again, where it says that once the Tribune company emerges from bankruptcy, the Times will likely be put up for sale, and, quote, the price should be better and the advantages of local ownership clear to all.
I believe
it's clear to many. you just in the newspaper the other day, you were quoted as saying you were talking to potential partners for such a purchase. Can you tell us anything more about that?
Well, people have approached me over the years, but there's no current discussion going on.
Well, let's talk afterward.
Okay.
Just good. Kidding. Can I ask one more question on this, only because I wouldn't kick myself if I didn't ask it. How would the Times be different if you owned it?
I want to make the Los Angeles Times more Los Angeles friendly. We've had great editors that I don't think love the city. I look at the New York Times, which loves New York. I don't see that same amount of love at the Los Angeles Times. The editors have been great. But the number of positive stories about Los Angeles have not been exactly numerous.
Okay, fair enough. I'll let you go on that. A couple more questions, and then we'd love to turn it over to all of you. So be thinking of your questions, and we'll pass the microphone around in a minute. I just thought we'd sort of close by talking to you a little bit about the other piece of your life, which is collecting. What led you to collecting art, and what is the satisfaction you take from it?
Edie was the first collector in our family, and I'd been involved in higher education as chair of a liberal arts college on the state university board, and was not involved in art. But I became curious. I've been curious about all my life about various things. And out of curiosity, I happened to meet someone by the name of Taft Schreiber, who was one of the founders of MCA, and he was a great collector. Learned about collecting from his clients, Edward G. Robinson and others. And he befriended me. And I found it fascinating. The first work of art we bought when I got involved was a Van Gogh drawing. But then we move forward in time. And as I met artists, museum curators, dealers, and the like, I said, let's look at art of our time. And I learned a great deal from these artists. It gave me a broader view of what American society is all about. So I enjoyed spending time with them in addition to spending time with lawyers, accountants, and so on. And I've gotten quite an education from that, and I think it's broadened my view of the world.
Mm-hmm. And do you exclusively collect the work of living artists?
Yes. When we started, they were all living. Some of them are gone now.
Yeah, well, understood.
Right.
Like Roy Lichtenstein was a great fan, Bob Rauschenberg and others, but most of them are living artists.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned Lichtenstein. The story, it's in your book, although I've seen it elsewhere too. Some people may not know it. Tell about the purchase of your Lichtenstein on your credit card. This is an experience that most of us will not enjoy, I suspect.
Okay. I go to the auction house, Sotheby's, and they had a great Lichtenstein at auction. And to bid at auction, you get a paddle. So I'm in line to get a paddle, and the woman in front of me asked, can I charge things on my credit card? And they said, yes, MasterCard or American Express, and explained it. So I thought that was interesting. So we ended up being the successful bidder, which I define as being willing to pay more for an object than anyone else in the world. Okay, so then I came back and I made some inquiries about could we charge it. And I found you can get miles for that. And further, you get 20 more days to pay something like that. So I went ahead and charged in our credit card, $2.5 million.
I'm going to interrupt you for a moment to say that in the book you describe it as a high limit card.
whatever. At any rate, we took those miles and we gave them to students at Cal Arts so they could go to the Edinburgh Art Festival and some other things. And I want to keep it quiet, but there was a New York Times reporter by the name of Carol Vogel that kept calling. And I ignored it. Finally, I said, tell Carol Vogel I did it for purposes of convenience. And that became a lot of chit-chat in the New York cocktail world.
And the follow-up question, I guess, is naturally, does Sotheby's still take credit cards?
Oh, no, at the next auction. at the next auction we're at, the auctioneer said... we no longer take credit cards. Sorry, Eli.
And the final question I'll ask you, and then we'll turn it over to you guys. What are some of your favorite pieces in your collection, either that you have today or that you've collected over the years that really have meaning for you?
There are a lot of them, but let me mention two things. In the early 80s, we got involved with a lot of young artists. Jean-Michel Basquiat, who was working in the dealer's basement in Soho. We first saw Cindy Sherman's work, in again, the basement of a dealer on Mercer Street in Soho. We saw Jeff Koons' early work before these people were really recognized. And we're fortunate to be able to buy the work and keep buying the work ever since. So we've got the biggest collection of Cindy Sherman's work. And if you haven't seen the great exhibition at the Museum of Modern Art, I urge you all to see it when you're in New York. Jeff Koons, the same thing. There are lots of artists that we collect. Mm-hmm.
And with the completion of the Broad, I assume we'll have ready local access to a lot of this material.
Yes, right now, the two collections, our personal and found, have about 2,000 works of art. Right now, they're stored at 5 different facilities in Culver City and El Segundo, and we've got a small building in Santa Monica that's not really open to the public. Here, we'll have the ability to store the art, show about 200 or 300 works, and continue our lending program.
Mm-hmm. When will the Broad open?
Well, the end of 2013 or very early in 2014.
Great.
And it's moving right along.
Yeah, we drove by it the other day, and right, it's come up above ground level. You can really see it now. Well, congratulations on that, too. Well, all right, let's hear from all of you. Who would like to ask a question? Sir, wait till we get a microphone to you, just because it otherwise won't go on the recording.
Pleasure to hear you speak, by the way.
I am curious to know what qualities you possess, in your opinion, that allowed you to be successful at two such disparate businesses, and how you transitioned from home building to insurance.
Oh boy, my career started as a young CPA, the youngest in the state of Michigan, but that got boring after 2 years, frankly. And I had clients, or my boss had clients that were home builders. And I studied the industry and so on and said, gee, I could do that, but I need a partner. So I found Don Kaufman, who had a background in construction. And we started, and one of the first unreasonable things we did was we built houses without basements, which was unheard of in Detroit. But I said, you know what, they're doing that in Ohio, in Dayton, Indianapolis, Indiana, etc. And all the old hands in home building said, one, no one can buy your houses. Two, you guys are going to go broke, etc. But I did a lot of homework and went ahead, and it all worked out. And the first weekend, we sold the 16 homes we had for sale. So that started that. We acquired in 1971 a company founded in 1890, Sun Life Insurance Company of America. And we kept that for a number of years, and it was, frankly, just another boring life insurance company doing normal things. And I said, why don't we find a niche? And we went into retirement savings business and changed it to Sun America, which was a great success. So I don't know how to answer your question other than that, but I've surrounded myself with great people, both in home building and in Sun America, who helped make all that happen.
Yes, over here.
Oh, thank you. I'm intrigued by your comment about the lack of a philanthropical spirit in Los Angeles. I've been here 10 years myself, having lived in New York for 10 years, and I've noticed it. Also, your comment about the Los Angeles Times, you know, not just the editors, but the reporters, too, having no apparent love for the city, whereas in New York, it's really quite different. Now, you yourself seem to be able to rally up funds for a lot of important projects. I'm just wondering if you could say a little more about this lack of a philanthropical spirit. It's certainly not for the lack of money around here, right?
No, it's not. We've got more members of the Fortune, the Forbes 400 here than probably any other city in America, or California does. I think the problem is the way the city developed. Unlike New York, where you start with the island of Manhattan, or Chicago, we start with the Loop and so on. So when I first started coming here in the late 50s, early 60s, people said, look at it, 100 suburbs trying to find a city, or it's one big Queens. And there was no center. And I used to kid around and said, no one's from Los Angeles. They're either from Pasadena, the Valley, Beverly Hills, Santa Monica, etc. That's starting to change somewhat, and that's why I believe that we have to have a vibrant downtown center. And that's happening with LA Live, which is our, I view as our convention, sports, and entertainment district, and Grand Avenue, which is our will be our cultural and civic district. And I think the population will go up dramatically in the next 5 to 10 years. That'll help. We also have some industries here that are great, but those industries don't participate in many civic activities the way they should. The last person in the entertainment industry that I thought was a great citizen was Lou Wasserman. And I hope some of the other leaders of the various studios will get more involved in the general community.
You may, before we go to the next question from there, let me ask you a little follow-up there. You mentioned Grand Avenue. What is the status of Grand Avenue now, and when do you expect to see it really come to fruition?
Okay. One, I mentioned the park. That's mm-hmm. underway, and that happened because I convinced the related companies to give us a non-refundable $50 million deposit, which has grown as a result of interest to pay for the park. So that park's being built without any public money. We're going ahead on the corner 2nd and Grand. We're also going ahead and building a plaza next to it. We're also widening the sidewalks on both sides of Grand Avenue, so it's more pedestrian-friendly. Related is going ahead and building a 17-floor rental building right next to it. So that's happening. Now, what's happening across the street from Walt Disney Concert Hall? Frank Gehry had great design. Because the economy has been put on hold, I was visiting with related with Steve Ross, the CEO in New York, several weeks ago, and it's going to happen. I think they're going to start, and I can't predict the exact date, but in the next 2 years.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Who else? Yes.
Mr. Brode, could you comment on what do you think the role of the public library is in establishing a vibrant city, and what role do you see it playing in the future?
Well, I believe in libraries, and I see what the New York City Public Library does, and I think this library is doing great things for the city, and the system's doing great things, and I hope it. As population here grows and more people come downtown, they'll be more involved in library activities.
Do we have one over here?
Yes. Hi, Mr. Brode. Thank you so much for living in my city. It just makes it so wonderful. I have a small nonprofit in Guatemala with a wonderful staff and a very young executive director. And I would like to help cultivate her leadership potential. And I'm wondering if you have any advice for me on how to do that.
I'm not sure I have any specific advice other than if you have a definable goal and feel passionate about the mission, you've got to push these people. I've been able to get people to do more than they think they could. And sometimes they're not happy when I challenge them to do this or that, but at the end of the day, they accomplish more than they think they could, and thank me for it.
Well, this is a question. Right here, down front.
Oh, wait, I'm sorry, I'm going to interrupt you. I'm going to ask you to wait for the microphone. We have time for maybe one more after
this.
We're
living in what is called recessionary times. What advice can we do to the city to get people from being unemployed to employed when businesses are closing?
Look, the big problem we have in Los Angeles and California and most parts of the nation is K-12 education. The world has changed, but public school systems have not changed. And they're broken. We got to change the system. We've got to start using technology and go into blended learning. We've got to get more money in a classroom. We've got to get better teaching, including incentive compensation for great teachers, and do a lot of other things. And if that happens, I think if you look at unemployment rates for college graduates, only about 4%. So I don't have any real answer. I think the city ought to increase its economy in two different ways. One, we've got to promote cultural tourism. New York, London, and Paris get 10 to 15 million people a year coming for culture. We get about 3, 4 million. Although we've got, no one has better symphony or symphony hall than we do. We've got great operas, you know, with Plaza Domingo. We actually have more theatrical productions, although they're spread out, than New York or London. We've got great museums, more contemporary art gallery space and museums than any other city. So we've got to promote cultural tourism, and that's starting to happen. Then we've got to do more in biotech. Look, USC, UCLA, and Caltech graduate great people. You know what? They leave town. They go to Northern California or San Diego to start their businesses. So we've got to do both of those things.
Is there a role for either a failure of political leadership in the city that leads to that, or a role for a different kind of leadership from the elected leadership, rather?
Well, look, we do not have the corporate leadership that other cities have. I've spoken to the New York City Partnership, and it's a joy. All the heads of all the banks, real estate people, and others get actively involved. You don't have that here. Two, I don't think what we have here in our political system makes a whole lot of sense, frankly. You've got a mayor and 15 council people. Then you've got the county board of supervisors with five emperors and empresses, not frankly, not working together. I don't see these people having a great vision for what this city ought to be. So I don't know what the answer is to that, other than someday maybe we could merge the two. Or to me, I'd love to have the city of Los Angeles become a separate county where all the services would be in one place with the rest of Los Angeles County governed by the supervisors.
Fair enough. You heard it here first. I think we may be down to one more. Yes, why don't you finish this up?
Thank you.
Thank you for your remarks. You have made, you clearly have made a huge difference, particularly at a large macro level. I'd be very interested, based on your own growing up and your own accomplishments, to hear what advice would you give to a young person growing up in Los Angeles today who wants to make an impact in this city. What would you say to them?
Well, have a dream. Pick something that you think needs to be done, whether it's something new or something that needs to be improved, and just go for it. I don't have any formula for them. And don't take no for an answer. Ask a lot of questions. Why not? Why can't we do this or that or the other thing? And if you don't get answers, just go ahead and be unreasonable and move forward.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, Errant Fox, City National Bank, KPMG, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, and the Bujaki Foundation. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Council of the Library Foundation, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and LA Weekly. The Aloud theme was composed by Larry Karish.